This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. A short-handed U.S. Supreme Court wrapped up an unusual term recently with only 8 justices, releasing a slew of decisions on issues that the country has long debated. This hour in The Exchange, we focus on 3 of them. The first concerns gun ownership and domestic violence, with a court majority agreeing to some restrictions. The second will cover attempts to define corruption in public office. While the case itself involved just one former Virginia governor, the decision could have wide implications for elected officials everywhere. And lastly, we'll look at the use of race-based affirmative action in college admissions, why the court surprised many when it upheld this policy at the University of Texas. Let's hear from you two this hour. Give us a call with your questions and comments. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We have 2 guests in studio. John Graby is here. He teaches constitutional law at UNH Long Concord. And John, it's good to see you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Jennifer Sargent, Associate Professor of Writing and Rhetoric at Dartmouth, a former law professor, district court judge, and public defender. And Jennifer, good to see you too. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, before we get into these 3 cases, which are really interesting, I did want to ask you about this unusual court. And Jennifer, to you first, 8 justices after the death of Justice Scalia in February. What's been the effect of this?
Well, there have been a few effects. One of the most notable effects has been the potential or actual tie vote on some pretty important cases, notably, for example, the immigration case out of Texas. And what a tie on the bench creates is an affirmation of the lower court opinion. So the case that came out of Texas regarding immigration, the court really didn't have any choice to decide that case because there were 4 justices in the affirmative and 4 justices who didn't agree with the lower court. And so the lower court stands. There's no opinion. There's no precedent. It's just simply what it was at the lower court. Additionally, there have been a lot of writs of certiorari, which are the petitions that petitioners file with the Supreme Court to ask them to take cases, to accept cases. And the court this term since Justice Scalia died has been pretty reluctant to accept writs of certiorari. So there's a lot there are fewer cases reaching the Supreme Court because of the split.
Because they just feel like they don't have enough justices to manage the workload, or because they're afraid that there'll be all these 4-4 decisions, so why bother?
Well, I think that definitely they're considering the fact that they don't want to take cases where they don't know what the preliminary vote's going to be because they see a tie as not creating any new law. And they want to consider and make new law and new precedent or affirm precedent or law. They just don't have the opportunity to do that with the split court.
How unusual is this, John? Have we seen this in recent memory?
Not in recent memory, and certainly because of the position the Senate is taking with respect to holding hearings and confirming the nominated successor. The length of time without a full court we haven't had anything like this in a very long time. It's truly unusual. I remember reading back at the beginning of the term, a lot of people were thinking that, I saw one article said that, this might be the term where the empire strikes back. Last year, there were a couple of decisions that were very, very well received by the more progressive or liberal community. The docket this year was lining up as if there would be some conservative victories, and a number of those didn't take place. A number of those were cases that ended up splitting 4-4, and it's really pretty clear that if Justice Scalia had been able to vote vote in those cases, those would have gone the conservatives' way.
So that's interesting. When the court opened in October, I guess,
right?
People thought, okay, this could be a good year for the more conservative wing of the court on several key cases. And then he died in February, and so that didn't happen.
That's right. Jen mentioned the immigration case, Texas versus United States. There was a case out of California involving the First Amendment rights of members of people who choose not to join a public sector union. Everyone thought that the court was going to say that you have a First Amendment right not to pay dues in such a case. That split 4-4. The contraceptive mandate case, that almost certainly would have been a case that the conservatives would have won. That didn't split 4-4, but the court basically punted on it. They basically sent it back to the lower court saying, it doesn't seem like you guys are so far apart. Work this one out, which is something the Supreme Court never does.
Well, there's lots and lots and lots of cases we could talk about. This hour, we picked three that we really want to focus on because they may have some repercussions here in New Hampshire. And let's focus, first of all, if we could please, on the decision that came out of a Maine case, Jennifer, concerning gun ownership and when ownership can be denied. Just remind us, please, Jennifer, what this ruling or what this case was about.
So this case was a case where the Lautenberg Amendment to the Gun Control Act of 1968, which allows for confiscation or prohibition of possession of firearms to happen to individuals who have been convicted of misdemeanor crimes of violence. And misdemeanor crimes of violence are often crimes that are defined under simple assault statutes, under simple assault laws or other types of laws. And so what happened in the Maine case is that the simple assault, the aggression, so to speak, happened not intentionally or knowingly, which are two states of mind that courts often use to describe, well, that statutes often use to describe what people's mindset has to be when they commit an act. But in the Maine case, it regarded an act where the mindset was recklessly, and recklessly carries with it a connotation of not necessarily intent or knowledge that you're going to injure or potentially injure somebody, but rather that you engage in conduct that so significantly disregards a risk that an ordinary person wouldn't have engaged in that conduct.
So just getting back to basics, though, about like who brought this case, what they wanted, how the court denied them. Correct me if I'm wrong, please. Two men in Maine were both convicted of misdemeanor domestic violence.
That's right.
And they were told you can't own a gun because of this. And they said, no, no. That's a misinterpretation of the law because these were misdemeanors, not felony assaults.
Well, they were
misdemeanors.
Is
that right?
Yes, they were misdemeanors, but they were misdemeanors that happened with the mens rea of recklessly, not the mens rea, which is the mindset of intentionally or purposefully. So in the case, Justice Kagan, who wrote the opinion, talked about a reckless act being as follows. Someone flings a plate at a wall, doesn't aim for anybody, doesn't try to hit anybody, but just in anger flings a plate. But someone is standing close by, and that person, when the plate shatters, is injured by, say, a shard of the plate that nicks their skin and causes bodily injury. That's a reckless offense because although the person didn't mean to aim at anybody or actually endanger anybody, one should know that when you fling a plate, a shatterable plate, at the wall, it can shatter. And if someone's in the area of, you know, the shatter zone, so to speak, that person can be injured. So what the Supreme Court did is it said, just like intentional and knowing assaults, reckless assaults now qualify as misdemeanor crimes of domestic violence such that a person cannot own, possess, transfer, et cetera, a firearm if they've been convicted of that.
So it expanded the definition of what types of domestic violence can be counted to deny somebody the right to gun ownership.
Yeah, it really clarified that all of those assaults fall under the prohibition in the Lautenberg Amendment. Oh,
okay, and I went around and around on this yesterday, John, reading up, and this word reckless and, you know, unknowingly assaulting someone and not intending to insult someone, and it's very tricky. I can understand, you know, if there's a car accident, maybe you not on purpose hurt someone, but the throwing a plate when somebody's nearby, I don't know. Help me figure this reckless out.
Well, you know, it's a pure case of statutory interpretation. The federal statute under which these guys were prosecuted says that if they stand convicted of a state misdemeanor involving the use of force against somebody in a domestic situation, that they're prohibited from owning a gun in the future. And so the question is, should that prohibition only apply to people who knowingly or intentionally inflicted injury on others, or should it also be applied in situations where people behaved in a very, very careless way, in a way they should have known was likely to cause injury, but they didn't necessarily intend to cause that injury? So the court had to sort that out, and the court ruled that, in fact, those convicted even of crimes involving merely reckless conduct do suffer the prohibition under federal law. One of the interesting aspects of the case was the fact that Justice Thomas took the position that the statute should be narrowly read rather than broadly read. So he dissented in this case, joined, interestingly, by Justice Sotomayor, though not with respect to this part that I'm going to talk about in a second, which is that Justice Thomas said, because this is taking away a fundamental right, we ought to be narrowly reading the statute rather than broadly reading the statute. Justice Sotomayor didn't agree with that, but did agree with Justice Thomas that the statute should be more narrowly read and that the disability should not be as expansive.
This is the first time Justice Thomas has asked a question in a decade,
yeah,
John?
Is that right? This was the case shortly. This was just a few days after Justice Scalia passed away, and it was a decade. It had been a decade before Justice Thomas spoke, and everyone was shocked, and he asked a number of questions about this Second Amendment issue.
You want to jump in, Jennifer? Go ahead.
The court spent a lot of time figuring out what it wanted to do by wrestling with the phrase use of force. The question was really whether use, the word use, and whether use of force fell logically within the definition of recklessly. So in other words, whether one uses force, does it or does it not require some sort of intent element? And the court ultimately decided that no, it does not require some sort of intent-like element, that use can be something that is an engagement of force on anything that subsequently causes injury, say, as a ricochet or indirectly.
So 6-2 in favor of expanding the category of people who would not be allowed to own guns. Are you surprised by this, Jennifer?
I'm not surprised by it. As John said, it's a very limited question of statutory interpretation. But what is interesting is that Sonia Sotomayor joining Justice Thomas, she has a lot of prosecutorial experience. She's probably the justice who has the most in the trenches criminal experience. And as a prosecutor, she's had to grapple with these ideas of states of mind, acts, criminal acts.
Did you really mean it or not?
Exactly.
Was it really an accident?
Exactly. So I have to feel like her experience really lends to her rhetoric in this instance and her decision making. And she really was applying the real life aspects in some respect to that recklessly definition, as opposed to just sort of the statutory interpretation of it as the other justices were.
But dissenting and saying, no, this definition should not be expanded.
Right. She really thought that use of force really it required some sort of intentional like quality.
A couple more questions on this, but let me also invite our listeners to join us. The exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in the Exchange, we're looking at three key recent decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court at the end of its term. The one we're looking at now involves gun ownership and domestic violence cases. A little bit later, we'll look at another decision that tries to define what constitutes corruption by politicians. That's an interesting one with possible implications for our citizen legislature here in New Hampshire. You can join us 1-800-892-6477. Your questions and comments are welcome. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Or, of course, you can just give us a call. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So, John Graby, how does this recent decision on, again, gun ownership and domestic violence cases, how does this compare to past Supreme Court decisions on guns?
Well, you know, actually, the majority opinion, I agree with Jennifer. It's really, you know, the case itself, the holding is not that remarkable. It was just, you know, it was just a disagreement about a possible ambiguity in the statute. And a majority of the court chose to read the statute more expansively to limit the right of gun possession to a broader group of people than the dissent would have. To me, the most interesting part of the case, again, is really that Justice Thomas viewed the Second Amendment as a fundamental right that he actually compared to the First Amendment. In his dissent, he said, for example, that there are a bunch of states – I didn't even know this – a bunch of states actually still allow misdemeanor prosecutions and convictions for libel. I don't think it's a very common thing. And he said, could you imagine if Congress passed a law saying that anybody convicted of libel as a misdemeanor, if Congress took away their First Amendment rights for the rest of their lives, we would strike that down immediately. And so what's interesting to me there is that he views the Second Amendment right that was identified and protected a few years ago, not only as a fundamental right, which is what the Supreme Court has held, but he views it as really tantamount to other fundamental rights, such as freedom of speech. It's interesting. It's a provocative position.
Well, and Justice Scalia wrote the opinion on that hugely important Heller case to do with gun rights and so forth, John, really reestablishing or reaffirming that individual right to bear arms. What do you think Scalia would have said on this particular case concerning domestic violence and guns?
Oh, I bet he would have been with Justice Thomas. I think it is a canon. They call the canons of statutory construction. These are just rules for how to read statutes. And the court will frequently read a statute so as to avoid a constitutional problem. So if there's two ways to read a statute, one would raise a constitutional issue, the other wouldn't. The court says, we'll go with the other one. We'll avoid constitutional problems. That's what Justice Thomas was arguing. I think Justice Scalia would have been right there with him. So I think it would have been a 6-3 decision rather than a 6-2 decision.
Jennifer, just out in the rest of the world, the non-legal world, how are people on both sides of this gun issue interpreting this decision?
Well, specifically in New Hampshire anyway, you know, the people in the real world are dealing with it as if this has always been the case. Frankly, my experience in New Hampshire as a district court judge and also as a public defender, we have had in New Hampshire protocols in place for many years for domestic violence cases. The simple assault statute, which was to some extent subsumed in a special statute on domestic violence, because New Hampshire now has a special domestic violence statute. The protocols from the Attorney General's office call for, in the case of a misdemeanor domestic violence conviction, regardless of the fact that the mindset might be intentional or knowingly or recklessly, the law enforcement is usually directed, in fact, in my experience, always directed by the judge to seize firearms if the person has firearms.
So New Hampshire already takes this approach that the U.S. Supreme Court has taken.
Yeah, absolutely. But now it's clarified that it's absolutely okay.
All right. Well, coming up, we'll take your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. And we'll turn our attention to another Supreme Court case that tries to define what is political corruption and what isn't. All that coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at three recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions on guns and domestic violence. Later, we'll look at political corruption and how it should be defined. And then we'll look at affirmative action in college campuses. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. John Grabe is here. He teaches constitutional law at UNH Law. Also with us, Jennifer Sargent, Associate Professor of Writing and Rhetoric at Dartmouth, a former law professor, district court judge, and public defender. One more time, the exchange number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. And John and Jennifer, let's go to the phones. And John's joining us from Hillsborough. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Go ahead, John.
I would just like maybe the panel to comment on the likelihood that after this case, people will be less reluctant to plead. My impression is that convictions for misdemeanor would often be pled down, and now people may reconsider whether the consequences of accepting such a plea, and it may make it, and lawyers will probably have to warn their clients of this as a possible consequence.
John, this is a great question. Thank you for calling. And Jennifer, a lot of people have been looking at this, whether people would be less likely to work it out in court because they would understand that their guns might be taken away.
Yeah, I think that that's a terrific question and a reality, frankly. Remember, a misdemeanor is not just a misdemeanor. It's not a violation-level offense. It's not a traffic ticket-level offense in the minor sense. A misdemeanor carries up to a year in jail and a fine that's significant at its maximum. So there are really severe consequences that can come from being convicted for a misdemeanor. In terms of will people be reluctant to plead, people are already reluctant to plead. My experience defending clients and serving as a judge, I was primarily in the North Country where there's a lot of gun possession for hunting, sport, even getting food. So these are the kinds of consequences that are called collateral consequences, meaning that in the first instance, a judge doesn't necessarily or a lawyer have to tell their client about these collateral consequences of the federal law, meaning that under the federal law, the firearms can be confiscated because it's not under the state law. So what happens is now there's I always, as a defender, made sure my clients understood that if they took the plea, there was going to be this collateral consequence of the confiscation of any guns and other dangerous weapons.
And as you said, New Hampshire already does it this way, even before the U.S. Supreme Court had this ruling.
What I do think, though, is related to the caller's question, is how prosecutors will now bring charges. Because it's arguable in some cases that recklessness may be easier or less difficult to prove than, say, knowledge or intent. So I wonder if there's going to be an uptick in the number of assaults that are now charged as reckless when they cause bodily injury.
Well, and John, thank you for the call. John Grabe, a question for you. Another Supreme Court decision on guns was considered significant by some. The court declined to take up a constitutional challenge to a Connecticut gun law passed in the aftermath of the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. This Connecticut law bans certain semi-automatic weapons and large capacity magazines. The court decided not to take up this challenge. That's part of that 4-4 issue, right, where they just say, you know, we're going to set this aside.
It could be. It's always, you know, you never know for sure. I mean, the court hasn't taken up, even before Justice Scalia passed away, since it's made its two decisions about guns, the Heller decision that you referred to before, and then a couple of years later in the McDonald case, the court said this Second Amendment right protects you not only against the federal government but also against the states. The court has stayed out. It's had a number of opportunities to go back into the Second Amendment area. It may well be that the court membership just doesn't doesn't want to get involved right now because there's so much controversy in the public sphere. They may think there's lots of ferment, there's lots taking place in the political process. Let's see how all of that shakes out. It only takes four votes to take a case. It takes five, you know, usually it takes five votes to win a case. So there's a lot of strategic thinking, too. And I can imagine justices on both sides of the issue looking and saying, hey, we don't know how the election's going to go. We don't know what the court's going to look like in the future. Let's wait.
Wait, I thought they were apolitical, highest court in the land. We decide the cases as they come our way and as the citizens of this country want them decided. And, you know, to heck with those other two branches of government.
Well, you know, I think that's debatable.
Well, John in Hillsborough, thank you again for the call. It's a good question. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And John Grabe, Jennifer Sargent, there's another case that really caught our attention on the exchange. It addresses the issue of political corruption. And although this, on the face of it, only had to do with one guy in Virginia, a lot of people think there are broader implications. So the Supreme Court made it harder to prosecute public officials for corruption unanimously. That's not a word you often hear, tied with the U.S. Supreme Court, unanimously overturning the conviction of Bob McDonnell, the former governor of Virginia. Just remind us, John Grabe, please, the particulars of this case. There's a lot of sort of, you know, here's many thousands of dollars to help pay for your daughter's wedding, and here's a nice watch, and here's some other gifties.
Yeah. And as Chief Justice Roberts wrote the opinion for the court noted, the facts are indeed unseemly at best. A large donor to Governor McDonald's campaign, a very, very strong supporter, a guy who over a period of time gave the governor and his wife about $175,000 in gifts and loans.
Wow.
And donations.
$175,000.
Yeah. I mean, there were quote-unquote loans to help with rental properties that the governor and his wife owned. There were extravagant gifts to the governor and his wife's daughter, who was getting married. A Rolex watch was purchased. There were flights on private planes. I mean, it's really, it's right out of the movies. So the governor was prosecuted under a couple different federal statutes that prohibit conducting or engaging in, and this is the key term here, official acts in exchange for loans or gifts. And so at trial, there was no doubt that this pattern of behavior had occurred. So this was purely a case about whether or not it fell within the statutory definition.
Of
official acts in exchange for loans or gifts.
So nobody denied that the governor got all this stuff.
That's right.
The question was, did he do anything to return the favor to Johnny Williams, who I think wanted his sort of herbal supplement approved by the legislature?
That's right. This guy had a company, and he was interested in having a supplement, a nutritional supplement, researched in public universities.
That's it, right.
Down in Virginia. And so he kept asking the governor, could you help me out? Can you set up meetings? I need to meet with this person. I'd like to meet with that person. And the governor did. The governor set up meetings. The governor hosted a reception at the governor's mansion and put this guy and his product front and center. And so the question is, were the actions that the government took, that the governor took, official acts, this setting up of meetings, this introduction, you know, hosting lunches, making speeches, all of these sorts of things. And the government—
Sounds pretty official.
Yeah, well, the government, you know, and the U.S., and in fact, the United States took the position that, yes, these were official acts. Anything that ultimately leads to some sort of official conduct can be regarded by the jury as an official act. That was the argument made by the prosecutors in the case. The defense was, of course, looking for a narrower definition, saying, you know, it has to be something like I will, you know, veto this bill, or I will, you know, do something in my official capacity in exchange for a loan or a gift. And that's how the issue was framed. The court instructed the jury in accordance with the government's broader theory, and the jury convicted. And so the case went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court had to decide, was the jury properly instructed, or were they permitted to convict him under too permissive a definition of what constitutes an official act? And the court agreed with the defense and said, you know, this is just the sort of thing that our politicians do. Our politicians set up meetings. Our politicians make
calls. They grease the skids, so to speak.
They do, yeah. And they're, of course, going to do it for people who sometimes are contributors. I mean, they're going to be responsive to their constituents. And we risk turning into criminal conduct the essence of what an elected representative does if we have too broad of a definition. And
well,
the court was unanimous on
unanimous
that.
Unanimous is pretty striking. What was also striking for me from this, Jennifer, is the extent to which Chief Justice Roberts said on several occasions, this behavior is unseemly, this doesn't look good. He said it more elegantly than I am now, but, you can't prove that the governor, you know, had this supplement approved or studied. He greased his skids, as I said. He tried to help make it happen, but he didn't make it happen. So, no, you can't convict him.
Chief Justice Roberts is a very savvy writer. And the way he presented this opinion was very smart. He wrote warts and all. So he included everything that was unseemly. He went on to say, notwithstanding the fact that these are very unseemly facts, we have an issue that we have to resolve in terms of a legal definition. That's all we're here to do. We're going to look at that legal definition and we're going to decide what it is. So the court defined pretty specifically what an official act is. And the court doesn't always take the opportunity, by the way, to define something so specifically. And it didn't go along, as John said, with the government's suggestions, and it didn't go along with the defense's suggestions. The definition was somewhere in the middle. But then the court did what's called remanding. The court actually sent it back down to the lower court and said, you're going to redo this trial.
Redo the whole thing.
Redo the whole thing with this new jury instruction that's going to incorporate this new definition. So Justice Roberts wasn't suggesting that Governor McDonnell didn't do something contrary to the law. What Justice Roberts was saying was, here are the facts. Notwithstanding the facts, there's a different definition that the lower court needs to apply, or at least tell the jury about it in instructions, so the jury can decide whether those facts meet the new definition.
Okay, so it's interesting in terms of this being kind of a, you know, a controversial case, and there's a People magazine element to it. But John, how does this apply to, you know, everybody?
Well, this is a pervasive problem. You know, when I worked for many years in the federal court, we had a bunch of cases involving prosecutions against public officials, and trying to draw that line, trying to identify, you know, I mean, everyone agrees that if you say, look, I'll propose legislation or I'll veto a bill if you give me money, everybody understands that that's illegal. But that's not, of course, you know, sometimes that happens. But, you know, more of the cases fall in the middle. They're in that sort of ambiguous middle zone. We all know that our politicians are going to do favors for constituents and that if you are a big supporter, you're more likely to get the attention of the person who represents you. We had a case involving Buddy Cianci, the former mayor of Providence, that went through the federal system when I was there. And it was a similar sort of thing. You know, all sorts of really unseemly stuff going on. But at the end of the day, was there really enough evidence there of a quid pro quo?
Right.
Exactly right. It's a pervasive problem. I think the court, it was concerned, as Jennifer said, about giving a clear definition so that these cases can go forward and everybody understands where the line is. I think the court was also aware that there is also the opportunity for ambitious prosecutors who are opposed to public officials to bring these sorts of claims. You know, you may remember Rick Perry was the subject of a criminal investigation last year down in Texas by a prosecutor who just so happened to be from, you know, the other political party. The abuse can go both ways. And I think this I wasn't surprised, actually, by this outcome. I think a lot of people saw this coming.
Jennifer?
There was also a while back the Ted Stevens case from Alaska that had a similar bent to it. And he was acquitted of all charges. So it's important to recognize, though, that the justices themselves are officials as well, public officials. And they, too, have the experience of having trips bestowed upon them, taking the opportunity to interact with folks when they're not on the bench, and they have the experience of being public officials. And it's always true that whenever a court decides an issue, personal experience, though not always directly relevant, does inform the way a judge interprets the law. And I think here the court was really trying to balance the interests of the prosecution and of the legislators, to allow legislators or governors, executives, or even judges to do what they need to do without having to worry about everything they say or everything they do, not only for zealous prosecutors to latch onto, but also just to allow government to function.
Well, and Chief Justice Roberts said the basic compact underlying representative government assumes public officials will hear from their constituents and act appropriately on their concerns. This is quoting him now, whether it's the union official worried about a plant closing or the homeowner, homeowners who wonder why it took 5 days to restore power to their neighborhood after a storm. He said that this McDonald case could cast a pall of potential prosecution over these relationships. But it's hard to imagine the homeowner, giving $15,000-$20,000 to help pay for the daughter's wedding.
Right.
So the good government types, John Grabe, the sort of no money in politics groups, were really upset by this.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, like you say, let's not kid ourselves. Yes, politicians will pursue policies that their constituents favor, but we all know that certain constituents, those who are able to make their support known to the politicians tend to have the phone answered a little bit more quickly. It was just a loud message from the court that, look, this is the nature of the process we have. It wasn't intended to be a pristine process. It's not a pristine process. But we're talking here about the criminal law. And as Jennifer said, I think there was a lot of empathy on the part of the justices who themselves, are the subject of articles about, teaching a class in Italy over the summer and getting paid $20,000 by some group that, may come from the conservative side or the liberal side. Justice Scalia famously went duck hunting, right, with Vice President Cheney at a time when cases involving the Bush administration, of which Cheney was a part, were going to the Supreme Court. And a lot of people thought that was unseemly. And I think, I think the judges, while not condoning what happened in this particular case, are worried see this as a real potential for abuse and misunderstanding.
Go ahead, Jennifer.
There's been some public indictment of this decision as well. Interestingly, a couple of days ago in The New York Times, Jack Abramoff, who's a notorious public
official,
lobbyist, who got in big trouble for quid pro quo for exactly this, he wrote a scathing op-ed about this decision and said the court just doesn't get it.
Well, and at a time when a lot of voters tell pollsters they feel the system is rigged, this probably doesn't make them feel any better.
Probably not.
All right. We will talk more in just a moment. We'll cover one more case, this one having to do with affirmative action in college admissions. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at three recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions. We've looked at a case involving gun ownership and domestic violence. We've just finished up talking about what constitutes corruption by public officials. And in a moment, we'll turn to a third ruling about affirmative action in college admissions. Join us, 1-800-892-6477, with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have two guests. John Grabe is here. He teaches constitutional law at UNH Law. Jennifer Sargent is with us, associate professor of writing and rhetoric at Dartmouth College, a former law professor, district court judge, and public defender. And Jennifer, one more question on this public corruption case. How might New Hampshire lawmakers and voters in particular view this decision? We've got a citizen legislature. They basically don't have a salary. I mean, it's $100 a year and plus mileage. So does this have any impact on how our own state officials act?
Well, if I were a state official in the citizen legislature, I'd be relieved, frankly. I would
relieved.
I would be relieved. I'd feel like I would have guidance now, a clear delineation of what I can do and what I can't do, an affirmation from the court that I can interact with my constituents and the citizenry and not have to worry about being prosecuted for doing something like setting up a meeting or having a meeting in a place that might not be cost-free or neutral. I think I'd be happy.
So some welcome clarity.
Yeah.
For state officials.
I think so.
So, John, let's turn to this third case. And this was another very closely watched decision, affirmative action in college admissions. Now, the name in this case is familiar, John. Abigail Fisher. She's been around before.
This lawsuit has been to the Supreme Court and back down before. So this is not its first trip to the court. This was a lawsuit brought by a woman who was denied admission to the University of Texas undergraduate in 2008. So she is already through her college years. A lot of people actually argued that this case should never have been heard, that it's moot. In any event, the court never accepted that argument. But Abigail Fisher took the position that the University of Texas's use of race as one factor among many in deciding on college admissions, that violated her equal protection rights under the 14th Amendment. She had prevailed at the Supreme Court a couple of years ago.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. She convinced the Supreme Court that the lower courts had not properly followed equal protection law in evaluating the University of Texas's program. So the case was sent back down. This was, to me, the most surprising of the cases that was decided.
Really?
This turn, yeah, because University of Texas's procedures were upheld as constitutional by a 4-3 vote. So this was a decision handed down by only 7 justices. Justice Kagan recused herself because she had been involved in the case as Solicitor General before she went on the court. And so this was one of the few cases this term where there was no possibility of a tie. And Justice Kennedy went with the more liberal justices and actually wrote the opinion upholding what the University of Texas had done.
Now, just back up a little bit.
Sure.
Abigail Fisher, again, she's presented this case before. She won last time around. So why did she come back?
Well, she won in the sense that she convinced the court to tell the lower courts to do it over again.
I see.
So the court, the last time she was up a few years ago, she convinced the court that the lower courts had not properly, that they had been too deferential to the university. Everyone agreed that the University of Texas does take race into account. It has sort of a complicated admissions protocol, but for purposes of this case, race is one factor among many that is taken into account when the University of Texas, a public university, makes admissions decisions because the University of Texas believes that diversity, more particularly the educational benefits that flow from racial and ethnic diversity in the classroom, is an interest worth pursuing. And the Supreme Court in 2003 held that although we are very, very suspicious whenever government officials take race into account in any way, when a higher education institution takes race into account just a little bit, okay, not too much, no quotas, it can't be a dispositive factor, but it can be something that's part of the mix.
Didn't somebody say a factor of a factor of a factor in a factor? Like, in other words,
exactly.
A small factor, not a huge overriding factor.
That's right. That's right. And so a couple of years ago, the court said that Texas had not convinced it that it had been careful enough, that it had not taken too much account of race in the decision. They sent it back down and said to the courts, no, it has to be a very, very small factor. The lower court again upheld how the University of Texas conducted its admissions decisions in 2008. And this time, Justice Kennedy said, good enough.
Okay. Well, so how does this fit in, Jennifer, to this longstanding battle over affirmative action in college admissions? This is not the only college campus to debate this.
Well, the court really zeroed in on this narrowly tailored idea, meaning that the use of race, when it's used in a holistic approach to create diversity in a school, or in a college or a university, that use of race and that holistic approach has to be narrowly tailored to achieve the diversity goals and the educational goals of the system. So I think what the court was saying in this case was, well, first of all, Justice Kennedy and the majority did hold that University of Texas's approach, holistic approach that does have race as a small factor in that approach, that was narrowly tailored to achieve both the diversity goals and the educational goals of the university. I think that that's what is going to speak to universities and school systems most widely across the nation. I think it's going to be an issue of, all right, now we know that race can be used. Just how much, though, is going to be the issue because of this narrowly tailored language.
So it sounds like we'll see these cases again then. Doesn't sound like there's massive clarity and everybody says, oh, now I get it.
We will see these cases again. We'll see each of them tested under the narrowly tailored test. They'll be looking in each case on a case-by-case basis as to whether or not the formula works.
What signal does this send, do you think, John, to other institutions of higher education?
Well, you know, I guess the signal is that public institutions, if they want, okay, there's no obligation, by the way, to take race into account. And this is a decision that applies only to public institutions, so it has no effect on private institutions.
So they can do what they
whatsoever.
Want.
Well, there are federal statutes that govern private institutions, and if they want to hang on to their tax-exempt status, they are governed by non-discrimination statutes. But it's generally understood, at least right now, that private institutions may take race into account as well if they want to and not, you know, run afoul of the law, at least in jurisdictions which don't outlaw it. And a lot of states actually have passed laws saying we don't want our public or private institutions taking race into account. So it's not mandatory that it be done. One of the interesting things about affirmative action is that in 2003, the decision I referred to before, Justice O'Connor writing for the court, did uphold the use of affirmative action in the context of higher education. But she, in that opinion, said, look, in 25 years, we hope and expect that this will no longer be necessary. It was really a remarkable decision.
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was, you know, it was almost like a shot across the bow saying, look, it's OK for now, but it's not going to be OK in perpetuity. We're now halfway through that 25-year period. And I can't, you know, who knows what goes on in the court, but I can't help but to wonder if Justice Kennedy thought that it would do more damage to the institution to not let that precedent stay in effect, you know, for 25 years. Especially given that this is a practice that is on the wane. I mean, it is no longer legal for public school districts at the secondary level to take race into account. I mean, this is a very, very narrow enclave where affirmative action remains constitutional. It's in the higher education context only.
That's interesting. Let me remind everybody the phone number for you to join us with your questions about this. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. Jennifer, go ahead. I can see you want to jump in there.
One of the very interesting things about this case is that Justice Kennedy is the swing vote. And Justice Kennedy has never before taken the side that he's taken. And a lot of people have been wondering, why did Justice Kennedy swing the way he did in this particular case when it was so closely linked to the last Fisher case, obviously, and the cases before that. And I think it's exactly because of the reason that John said. I think that Justice Kennedy got to take a position that wasn't firmly entrenched on the left, so to speak. He got to play the moderate in the swing vote. And I think he was playing the long game, frankly, and taking the approach that maybe it's best to just let this play out and it may die out on its own.
Justice Kennedy is 80. From what I've read, shows no sign of retiring. And he did kind of play an interesting role this time around in this weird sort of 4-4 court.
Yeah, he's been, I mean, even before Justice Scalia died, he's been really the key vote. I mean, he was the author of the same-sex marriage decision and all of the decisions involving, you know, the Defense of Marriage Act that led up to that decision. You know, Justice O'Connor, Sandra Day O'Connor, sort of filled that role about 10 or 15 years ago. But when she retired and was replaced with a more conservative justice, it really fell to Justice Kennedy. And Justice Kennedy will on occasion – he's usually a fairly reliable conservative vote, but he will on occasion line up with the more liberal justices. So Justice Kennedy has been a hugely consequential justice, particularly in the last decade.
Will decisions, John, made by an 8-member court be seen as more vulnerable in some way, viewed by those involved in these cases as, I don't want to say illegitimate, but maybe incomplete and doesn't count as much and let's go back and try again?
I mean, some people might, argue that in urging the court in the future to revisit, a decision that was made by a court without a full complement. But, this happens. I mean, even when the court has 9 justices, there are many, many cases where particular justices are recused. And if the court decides something by a majority, it settles the issue. It's regarded as precedential. So I don't think that that's likely. I don't think the court is likely to be receptive to such arguments, though, somebody might make such arguments.
I see. So here we are again. You were eight justices last time, so we think you should hear us again. The court will say, no, we did a good job.
As long as they decided it by a majority. But as Jennifer said, on the 4-4 cases, those have no meaning. Those are all issues that I would expect to see back at the court once the court gets back to its full membership. I shouldn't say all of them, but many of them are issues that I wouldn't be surprised to see back at the court within the next year or two.
Well, and we talked about 3 key decisions again this hour, gun ownership and domestic violence, public corruption, and affirmative action in college admissions. Jennifer, just real quick, any other biggies that came out of the court this term that really caught your attention?
Well, the labor union case for the lack of its decision was pretty major. But as for the decisions that have been coming out, they've been coming out in a way that have not been particularly controversial. The court is not looking to make cultural shifts or big splashes for the most part during this term since Justice Scalia's death. I think we're in a holding pattern right now, and it's going to be interesting to see if the court wants to maintain that holding pattern.
That's interesting. So you think that they are intentionally not trying to create waves right now?
I certainly think that they're holding back. I certainly think that they know that if they have a tie, that the case is absolutely undecided at the Supreme Court level. I mean, there's no precedent that gets set. There's no statement that's been made. The court really only takes cases in order to make some sort of decision.
Right. Everything else is supposed to be settled at the lower levels.
And the reason that we have an odd number of justices on the court, and by the way, the Constitution doesn't say how many justices have to even be on the court. But the reason we have an odd number of justices is because we don't want the situation where no decision gets made. So I think this is definitely on the court's mind. Chief Justice Roberts has spoken out before Justice Scalia's death, in fact, about, the necessity to keep justices on the bench and make sure that the court is able to be active and do its job. Right now, it's just going to be interesting to see how long we go without a nomination.
Other decisions, John Grabe, that jumped out at you?
Well, there were several. The abortion decision that came out of Texas a couple of weeks ago, that was an opinion that actually Justice Kennedy did not write, but Justice Kennedy's position in the case was the driver. This was a case where Texas, like other states where a majority of the population opposes abortion, had enacted measures that made it more difficult for facilities to perform abortions, they had to have somebody, a doctor on staff with admitting privileges at a nearby hospital, that there needed to be certain facility upgrades. And it was really quite clear in the legislative record that the intent behind these laws was to make it more difficult for these sorts of establishments to continue to conduct business. And Justice Kennedy joined with the more liberal justices to strike down Texas's laws. That was somewhat in question. Justice Kennedy, of course, was part of the great compromise in 1992 that upheld the heart of Roe versus Wade in a decision known as Casey. That was a surprise at the time. Many people thought that Roe versus Wade was going to be overturned and the matter of abortion was going to be returned to the states for them to decide for themselves. But in the years since, he had shown a real some would say hostility to the abortion right, notwithstanding his vote in Casey. And in 2007, he wrote an opinion upholding a federal statute that banned a procedure that its opponents called partial birth abortion. And his opinion in that particular decision was really quite hostile to the abortion procedure. So I think many people wondered if was he having second thoughts as he got older? You know, some justices have changed positions on important issues late in their careers, but he joined with the liberals in this case, strongly reaffirmed the Casey decision. So that was an important case.
Well, it's interesting, too. You said back in 1992, Justice Kennedy, did X, Y, Z. My first thought was, wow, that was a long time ago.
I know.
1992. Both of you, there's so many more cases we could talk about. I really want to thank both of you for coming in. Real interesting stuff. And thank you for being here. And Jennifer Sargent, it was good to see you. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Jennifer Sargent, Associate Professor of Writing and Rhetoric at Dartmouth College, former law professor, district court judge, and public defender. John Grabe, good to see you, too. Thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you.
John Grabe, he teaches constitutional law at UNH Law. Remember, our conversation always continues online, on Facebook, and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Jessica Hunt. Our intern is Sam Ruthier. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.